This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello and welcome to Don't Stop Us Now. I'm Claire Hatton.
And I'm Greta Thomas. This show is all about sharing inspiration, uplifting stories, and practical career advice from innovative, original thinking, and pioneering women from around the world.
You can find us here every second week, or why not sign up at don'tstopusnow.co so you never miss a show.
Plus, you'd make our day if you could rate or review us. It really gives us a boost in more ways than one.
It sure does. Now it's time for this week's show. Hello and welcome to the show. Wowie. It's been a busy and interesting few weeks, hasn't it, Gret?
Yeah, it sure has. We've been juggling a bit and now it's already May.
I know, completely crazy. And interestingly enough, May was a significant month last year for our guest this week, former Olympic medalist, barrister, and now an independent member of parliament in Australia, Zali Steggall. For last year, Zali was re-elected to the federal parliament after a stunning, and for some, an astonishing victory in the same seat at the previous election 3 years earlier.
Yeah, Zali really is a pioneer in so many fields. She was Australia's first ever individual medalist and first Australian female medalist at a Winter Olympic Games. Plus, when she won the World Championship slalom skiing event a year later in 1999, she became the first ever person from the Southern Hemisphere to win that event.
Pretty incredible. And of course, it doesn't stop there, because as you heard earlier, these days, Zali is an elected member of the federal parliament. When she was first elected in 2019, she defeated a former prime minister.
No mean feat.
No mean feat at all. And she did all this as an independent candidate with no party support. But she had an army of enthusiastic supporters and volunteers.
Yeah, it was just an amazing accomplishment to defeat such a high-profile incumbent sitting MP.
Sure was.
Now, for full transparency here, last year when Zali ran for re-election, I worked pro bono on her campaign, managing the digital marketing and advertising aspects. Happily, we believe anyway, for women, for integrity and for the climate, she was re-elected.
So in this episode, you'll hear how Zali optimized for elite performance, how she made the transition from being a competitive skier to becoming a barrister, the unusual circumstances that helped her learn the importance of enjoying the moment, and why Zali decided to enter the competitive and often antagonistic world of politics.
Yeah, Zali has some really unique stories and experiences to share, so you're in for a treat. Enjoy this episode with the indefatigable and purposeful Zali Steggall. Zali Steggall, welcome to Don't Stop Us Now.
Well, thank you for having me.
Oh, we're excited to have you. Got such a fascinating and incredible career to explore and stories to explore. You may not know this, but the way we start all of our conversations with our amazing guests is to ask, Zali, if you were at a dinner party and sitting next to someone you hadn't met before and they turned to you and said, so Zali, what do you do? How do you typically answer them?
It's a tough one. I say I am a retired Olympic skier turned lawyer turned politician. I don't quite know that I would describe myself just as a politician yet.
Right. Well, that's interesting. Why is that?
I just don't really think of myself as a politician, which is quite interesting after 4 years. But your formative years are so powerful in how you view yourself and who you think of yourself. So I still very much define myself as an elite athlete, like as an Olympic skier, which, you know, it's been many, many years since I retired. So that's quite interesting in itself. But it really did form a lot of my psyche and how I approach challenges and opportunities. So I still think of myself as that elite skier. And then obviously, you know, a lawyer from the point of view of my career at the bar. And I feel like my life now as a politician is a natural extension from those two careers, because it's the competitiveness and the drive of the skier in politics, but it's also the thinking through the policy and the legal and the planning, the policy planning that you do from a legal background.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. And we can't wait to sort of dive in more, but particularly, you know, four-time Olympian, but you were born on the beaches in Manly. What's the story behind how you became so passionate about skiing?
Yes, it is pretty unusual being born at Manly Hospital. It's not usual territory for winter sports, especially when you think back to the 80s and 90s where, you know, it was certainly more challenging. My parents just love sports. So we do have a sporting tradition in the family. My grandfather played for the Wallabies. My dad played at premiership level in rugby union. My mum was a good swimmer and she loved skiing. So she took my dad down skiing once they met and started dating. And then they were hooked. And they travelled around Europe a lot when I was very little as a baby and when I was little. And they went to live actually in the French Alps in a ski resort called Morzine-Vorias. It's about an hour from Geneva. They bought a chalet and they had what they call a snow change. You know, everyone talks about a sea change, but they had a snow change. They went to live in the French Alps for a few years. And my brother and I grew up thinking skiing was an entirely natural sport to do for Australians. And we were hooked. And look, I was a very competitive kid, you know, only one of the two kids. My older brother Zeke had to grow up with me always being quite the pestering little sister that was very competitive. You know, very, very, very competitive at everything I did as a kid. So, yeah, we were hooked on skiing. I was one of the top for my age in the under 15s and the juniors in Europe. And then when we came back to live in Australia, I didn't really see the distance of being in Australia as an obstacle. And I set about studying by correspondence and travelling the world and doing winter in Europe and then winter in Australia in a row. So I kept going with skiing.
You know, and we talk a lot on this show about facing your fears and sort of taking action despite feeling that fear. And I imagine that skiing, certainly certain slopes in certain conditions or skiing after injuries could be pretty frightening. If I'm right, and that was a thing for you, how did you move through those fears?
I was never fearful in a physical sense of hurting myself, because to me that comes down to manageable risk. So have you done the training? Have you done the fitness training, the weights? Are you strong? Have you done the flexibility, the rehabilitation? You know, to me they were all things you could fairly control. And then you got to race day, and depending on the conditions, you know, you ski smart in that sense. For me, it was more, the biggest problem was the fear of failure is one of the most paralyzing aspects of sport, because you can do it 99 times great in training, but then you have to do it once in a race. And that fear that you're, you know, something's going to put you off track or something's not going to click into place. And that's where sport psychology plays such a huge part in a sport like skiing, because you can't do a PB. Every race is a new race. It's a different track. You never get two races the same. So you have to put enough experience in your memory bank through training and then trust yourself to draw on that experience on race day. And that's where your psyche can really get in the way if you start to have doubts or fears and overthink it, and then you can't, you know, you don't do a good race. So it was usually the problem is that fear of failure. And so if you fear you're going to fail, it's nearly like you're then not prepared to put it all on the line, and then you can't possibly be fast in that situation. So it's all about learning techniques mentally to visualize and prepare for race day, so that when you get there, you really, and it doesn't always work, right? There are plenty of races when it didn't work, but the few races where it did all fall into place for me were the ones where I really had a very clear race plan, I had a clear mental plan, and it all, you know, it falls into place. It's very helpful, all those techniques that I learned back then, I used when I was preparing for court cases and appearing in front of the judges as a barrister, and I also used during debates, during the election campaigns, and I've used in Parliament, right? So these are really good life skills to develop.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that, you know, practically, you know, the fear of failure must come up all the time, particularly in the types of work you're doing. So you mentioned sort of visioning what your race would look like. Are there other things that you would do that you do, you did then and you do now that actually sort of really set you up well that other people can think about?
Yeah, look, I think it's one of those things, you have to recognise your fight or flight reflex. And, you know, some people are different at that and have it more marked than others. So that's obviously where something's coming up, your anxiety is rising, your adrenaline's pumping, and everything in your body's kind of telling you to avoid the situation, or do you face the situation? And often for skiing, like you know, you'd get really nervous, and the big events like Olympics or World Championships, there's so much riding on it. It would be really easy to get caught up in the moment. And it was about learning techniques to you can't control those emotions and you can't dismiss them, but you have to learn to live with them, and how do you work with them to make them effective. So it was always about learning to control your breathing, having strategies in place when you start to recognize those emotions and feelings of what are you going to do. And I certainly have had plenty of fight or flight moments, you know, in front of a judge in court when, you know, you're being asked something that you've got to think on your feet, whether you know the answer or not. You've got to come up with a strategy, or you're in a very confrontational situation in Parliament or with the media doing an interview or in a debate. So they are all really good strategies. It's not that you don't feel the chemical response of the adrenaline pumping, but you have to learn to deal with it. So it's breathing, having sort of thinking strategies, taking a moment, all those kind of things are really important.
Yeah. I'm just sort of imagining, you know, that this must come up for you, you know, a fair bit, although it sounds as if you lean in, and maybe when you lean into fear, you get more used to it.
I do agree with that. I think it's really good to keep challenging your comfort zone.
Yeah.
And I try and keep doing that. And I see that not in a, it's not a reckless thing. I'm a very, I would say, risk averse kind of person, in the sense that I only take what I consider are measured risks. You know, I've had no major injuries in my whole sporting career, and I've been competing at various levels since I was 4 years old. So I don't take unreasonable risk. I'm very measured in that way. But I do agree, it's about leaning in, you know, get yourself outside your comfort zone so that you're constantly challenging yourself. You know, in my downtime, my fitness kind of hobby is doing ultra marathons, which is, you know, 100-kilometer events, which again,
yes, it is.
Again, incredibly daunting, but the process of leading into it, planning it and preparing for it is incredibly satisfying.
And so in the 100K, I don't know which point is likely to be the most painful, but what is the kind of thing that you then say or do to wrestle with your mind at the time?
Look, it's actually all in your routine. So it comes back to the things that I learned as a skier, which is routine and habits give you something to fall back on. So, you know, having a very clear process of what you do in certain situations, and knowing that you need to keep eating to make sure blood sugar level stays high so that you keep having rational thinking. The biggest mistake people do is they stop fueling, and so then you can't make clear decisions. So that ability to make clear decisions is really important no matter what you're doing in life. And so knowing what are the situations, what are the ingredients you need to make good decisions, and how do you try and replicate that as often as possible. And so they're the things that happen. I mean, in the 100K, you break it down into baby steps, and, you know, you've got a checkpoint every sort of 15 to 20 kilometres, and you only focus on one leg at a time. So, you know, at the start, generally, you get really emotional. I get emotional at the idea of what I've got to do, what I'm about to do. Like, you actually get teary when you think, oh, my goodness, I'm about to do 100 kilometers. And then you stop thinking about that. And then all you think about is the leg you're doing now. Yeah. So, you know, next checkpoint is 15 Ks. And you focus on what do I need to do in this section? So, is it steep? Is it flat? What do I need to eat or drink? And if you stay in the moment and focus on what your task at hand is, gradually you will chip away and you will get there. And that's why I guess that's my advice to most people in life is never let yourself be daunted or turned away from a big goal, because if you set that big goal, you then focus on all the little steps that are needed to achieve in the meantime. Before you know it, you will get close, like you will get there, but you have to have that strategy of stepping back and just stay in the moment of what needs to be done now.
Yeah, look, that is gold. And before we leave all these amazing sports stories, I want to take you back to Nagano 1998 Winter Olympics, and when I think you were about 24, is that correct?
Yeah, 23.
And you became, you achieved the dream, you became an Olympic medalist. How would you describe the feeling of that day?
Oh, look, it was amazing. Like, it was the culmination of lots of things slowly coming together. Like, it was a great season. I'd won the opening World Cup. I had a good start number. You know, I was in a good place. I was physically strong. Everything was ticking off, right? But there's still no guarantee. And in skiing, you have to do two runs. First run, you go in the order of your start number, and second run you go reverse order of your times from the first run. You have to finish both, and it's your finished result is the total time. I was in third place after the first run, so clearly in medal contention, but no guarantees, and you have to wait about 3 hours before you go to the second run. The girl that was coming fourth was only about 0.05 of a second behind me, so that's like 5 centimetres. It's like nothing. Yeah. So there's no safety margin here. You can't play it safe. You've got to put it all on the line again in the second run. And I do remember being at the start of that second run, taking a really big, deep breath and just thinking, right, this has been a long time coming. This is it. This is your moment. And then just thinking, right, just trust the process and trust your training, you know, do the same as what you've done a million times. And the run itself is 55 seconds. It's a blur because it's all happening really quickly, lots of turns and gates. But then I do remember crossing that finishing line and having just that moment of, in my head, there was silence because you're kind of holding your breath until you quickly cross the finish line and you turn and you look to see where the timing board is of what ranking you're in. And I needed to come through the finish line in first place to know that I had a medal for sure, because I was third after first run. And it was that moment of just like silence in my head until I saw the one next to my name. Mm-hmm. And then the, you know, the noise in the crowd and cheering comes in, and just that sense of relief of knowing that you've done it. Yeah, it's special.
Gosh, I almost feel like I was there.
Oh, yeah, I was like, it was great. That was a really vivid description. You stopped competitively skiing when you were about 28. How hard was it to then sort of transition in terms of really your self-identity, you know, because you'd not really known anything else?
Yeah, incredibly hard. So I was on my own. I had a couple of coaches that travelled with me, but I was on my own. There's no team support. So I was incredibly lonely and isolated in that life of skiing. I did, 26 winters in a row, 13 years nonstop. So I was quite emotionally burnt out by 2002. And that fear of failure was really overcoming me. I couldn't sleep anymore before races, and I didn't have anyone really helping me through that. So by the time I finished in 2002, I was just so relieved for it to be over because that emotional pressure was really getting to me. And I'd had a bit of a moment in 2001 when September 11 happened. Actually, I was at a race in New Zealand, and I remember waking up to go to this race, to the news, to those horrendous pictures, and feeling like sport was trivial in the scheme of things in the world, and that it was time to do something else. And I had done a Bachelor of Arts in Media and Communication by correspondence, so I had done the uni degree, and I felt like, and I always wanted to study law, so I felt like I was emotionally, I was really coming to my sporting career had run its course. I felt like I had given it a good shot. I had had some success and some failures, but I was satisfied with the effort I'd given it. So by the time I retired in Salt Lake City, I was sort of, I guess, emotionally a bit anxious about what was going to come next. It's really daunting to give up something that you're really good at, right? You've worked really hard to be really good at something, and then you're consciously deciding to give it up and having to think about, well, how am I going to define myself? What am I going to be in the future? And I look back on it now and I think I should have probably taken a bit of time and gone traveling and had a bit of fun. But I was very focused and nervous about what comes next. And so I was very keen to get started. So I did a bit of media work for about 6 months, but then I started my law degree immediately. Gosh. And had kids, wanted wow. to start a family. So it's incredibly hard to redefine yourself from elite sport. I think, mind you, in every career, it's quite hard when you leave something that's been so engrossing. And the most important thing for me was having a really clear and defined new goal. And what was I working towards? What was my next goal? And yeah. so for me, it was to become a barrister. So I was just really determined that I would have another career. I had a press conference in Salt Lake City when I was announcing my retirement after the slalom, and a journalist at the time said to me, what do you think's the highlight of your life? You know, focus on the sporting career. And I said, look, I really hope I haven't had it yet, because I'm about to turn 28 and I really hope my highlight is in front of me, not behind me, because it's a long time to go. I have lived by that, I think, motto, that no matter how big a high or achievement or what you do now, that shouldn't really stop you from thinking about what's next. And, you know, keep setting new goals is really important.
Yeah. Well, and it sounds like for you in particular, having a goal is just really critical in terms of how you, I guess, really how it drives your motivation and drives you.
It's kind of like Zali's operating system.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But one of the things you do learn with getting a bit older and more mature and a bit, you know, you realize it's really important to enjoy the process as well, because if you're only ever focused on, you know, success is achieving a certain goal, it's a very short-lived moment of success. And I experienced that in 99 when I won the world championships in Vail in the US, because, you know, you've been training all season, you're really focused on this event. I won the slalom. You know, it was the first time anyone from the Southern Hemisphere has won at the World Championships in skiing, and big deal. And then I remember sitting on the plane on my way back from the US to Europe to go to my next World Cup race, and I'm sitting in economy, stuck in the middle of a row of three with two people on either side of me, and just, you know, having a fairly uncomfortable flight and thinking, yeah, well, that was great. Don't know that winning the World Championships has really changed my life. That was probably the first time I really realized you have to enjoy the process, not just think that achieving the goal is going to be the be and end all, because it won't in itself.
So important.
One of the few good things to ever come out of a middle economy row seat.
You know, and so you had your bar career, and then you made another major transition, which we've already touched on, to put your hand up to contest the sort of very safe, for those listening overseas, it's a federal political seat in the Warringah is the name of the electorate, and it was held by a man called Tony Abbott, who had been prime minister pretty recently. So,
happens to be where we live as
yes,
well.
Yes, yeah. And many would regard that as a shoo-in for him. And you became an independent political candidate. What was the motivator and the driver to get you to make another big career transition, this time from being a barrister to becoming a political candidate?
Yeah, I had been at the bar now 10 years, and I enjoyed my career as a barrister and the advocacy of it, but I was a little frustrated sometimes that I felt it was quite narrow, right? I was pretty frustrated with the state of Australian politics. You know, the fact that there's just not enough women around the table really frustrated me. In my board roles, I was really pushing for 50-50 board gender equity in all sorts of, you know, from a regulatory to a constitutional point of view within boards. So I was looking at our politics and thinking, this is just crazy. We need to have more women at the table. But I was really, really frustrated with, the type of politics that Tony Abbott represented, which was really old school, stuck in the past, not really embracing opportunities of the present or the future, and not addressing the risks and issues we have, like from a climate change and environment point of view. So I was just personally ready for a new challenge, but also felt I couldn't, as a professional woman, sit there angry about the status quo if I wasn't prepared to step in and change it, or at least put myself forward. I certainly wasn't daunted by the prospect of taking on an ex-prime minister, but I was going to do it in a way that I felt gave me every chance of winning. So with a really strong professional team around me, but also really strong community support, and, you know, doing all the work, really putting the work in to make sure we gave ourselves best chance of success.
During that campaign, you were subject to kind of smear campaigns and the like, and pretty sort of no holds barred attacks in the media and the like. How did you get through those? What did you say to yourself, or how did you cope?
That stuff really doesn't bother me, I must say. My family was probably more upset with it, and my husband was probably more upset by some of it than I was. For me, that's just water off a duck's back, in that I think that negative commentary, it comes from a place of fear, and it comes from I often look at some of the trolls and the negative stuff you see on the media, and I always just feel like this is such a reflection of the person writing it more than me that they're writing about. So I wasn't too upset by most of it. I expected it. Again, it's, you know, you have to set your expectations. I expected it to be nasty and difficult.
What do you find the most challenging aspect of life or work as an MP?
It's probably not challenging, but I'd say frustrating is sometimes I feel the processes in Parliament around decision making are just not as robust as they should be, and they get caught up in ideology. And I sometimes feel like if I could just get a few people from every side and put them in a room, let's close the door, let's knock out an agreement here, like, let's, you know, a bit like a mediation. If you really had to get to the bottom of what the policy could look like, that would be a sensible policy, takes on board all the advice and recommendations, addresses risk, and everyone will be fairly happy. You know, no one gets everything they want, but you make sure it's good policy. I feel there's so many areas we could improve. So the frustrating part is not having the ability to lock everybody up in a room to do that.
What do you need? What do you need, Zali? Is it arms and legs? We're there.
No, so again, well, that's where minority government comes into it, because minority government forces much more collaboration, which is, you know, if you imagine a mediation or a negotiation, it means you will get a better outcome.
And, you know, in last year's federal election, your previous win was really key to inspiring a whole new wave of new and successful, thankfully, independent female candidates who are known as the Teal Movement, which was begun by you following from your campaign. How have things changed for you as a result of those other women getting in, if at all?
Really nice. So one of the great outcomes has been I'm in a professional environment with like-minded, like-valued professional women, incredibly smart and successful in their own fields. Like, right, everyone's come from very accomplished careers. We are all quite united around sort of a set of values of what we're hoping to achieve and what we're doing for our communities. But there's a real companionship about that as well. And I haven't had that in any of my professional careers. You know, sport's a bit hard because you're competing against everyone, so you make friends, but you are still competing. The bar was still very patriarchal and male dominated, so you have professional women friends, but you know, there aren't many. Whereas what I've found really exciting in this parliament compared to, you know, last parliament, I could hang out with Rebecca Sharkey and Helen Haynes, and, you know, there were, I definitely had sort of friends, but we were definitely a smaller group. Whereas with my fellow Teals, it's very supportive and really good. I've even noticed in parliament as a result, we also have more female chiefs of staff, we have more female, you know, top senior advisors. So you even see the women in the parties, even in parliament or staffers, I feel they are more visible and they are more confident.
I'd love to get you to cast your mind now over your whole career to date, because clearly the highlights may still be to come, Zali. But what event or occasion do you think has taught you the biggest lesson?
I feel like the whole 4 years has been a steep learning curve, just because even, you know, managing my team, I was an individual athlete and then a barrister where you're a sole trader. Now I have, you know, we have 1,400 volunteers that sign up. I have a campaign team of a good 20, 30 people, very committed, that are really working around the, or volunteering around the clock and often. And then I have an electoral office team where it's sort of half staff and half volunteers that are incredibly committed to the community. And so, you know, again, it's managing that, managing people's expectations, making sure they're getting the right opportunities, you know, that everyone's as respectful as possible. And you don't always get it right. You know, everyone is human, everyone makes mistakes, but it's been an incredible learning curve. And then trying to meet people's expectations and meeting people's definition of success.
You've got this, the job is all these different parts. It's the hyper local, and then it's the Canberra based kind of national and sometimes international. And you like to run crazy distances, and you, you know, you have a family, you have a partner and kids. What time do you get up, Zali Steggall?
Well, it depends. Yes. Sometimes for running, I do have to get up at 5 and go for a run if I've got to fit it in before a big day in Parliament. But Parliament House, again, is incredibly, the hours are insane. Like we, you know, it's not unusual to do a 17, 18 hour day, 4 or 5 days in a row down there. And that's full on. But that's me also trying to squeeze in an hour run in the morning. And, you know, but then that's the only time I get to myself in a very busy day of lots and lots of meetings and briefings and different things going on. So you do have to always carve out a little bit of time for yourself to have your clear thinking time. And for me, that's if I go out running, I, you know, sometimes I have to start by walking because I feel tired. But if you can start by walking and then you go to a run, and then you kind of come back and you feel satisfied that you've ticked that off, and then you're ready for the rest.
Zali, we really recognise that, you know, you spent a good time with us today, and you probably are very busy, so we want to let you go. But before we do, just one last question. It's quite a big one. What does success look like to you?
Oh, I've struggled with this. I don't know. Look, success, I guess for me personally, it is always knowing I've given it 110%. So knowing that I haven't cut any corners, I've done the best I could for it, and then the outcome is what it is, but I know I've really given it the best shot possible. So to me, I think that is success, because no matter what you're trying to do in life, there are always variables and there are always elements you can't control, and you can't control the outcomes. And it could come down to luck or other factors, whether things go one way or the other.
Well, so Zali, thank you so much for your time. It's been a wonderful conversation. There's so many sort of nuggets and insights that I'm sure our listeners will get. Before we go, for those people who don't know you, so probably most people in Australia have heard of you, but if you're outside Australia and they wanted to know more about you, where would they go to do that?
Well, my website, I guess, from a political point of view, zalisteggall.com.au sets out, I guess, who I am politically and what I stand for, a little bit of my background. Funnily enough, my mother has written a book called Alpine Beach, Susan Steggall, and it talks about my childhood. So anyone who's interested in my skiing years and my early years in France, that's got a lot of that in it. I guess it's online and there's lots of different bits and pieces. Yes. I probably will one day write a book about it all, but I haven't had time to do that yet.
No. we understand that. Absolutely. Yeah, well, thank you so much, Sally, and thank you for everything that you do.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you. And I hope everyone out there really comes away. If you come away with anything, just never be afraid to give it a go.
Brilliant. Love that.
Likewise. Thank you, Sally.
Thanks, Sally.
Thank you.
Zali said so many fascinating things there. I think I'm personally still reeling at the thought of 26 winters in a row. Can you imagine?
No, actually, I can't.
I know.
I don't think we've had many guests who can top Zali in terms of commitment to such diverse and ginormous goals. Whether that goal's winning an Olympic medal, running 100 kilometres, or trying to shift a country towards better policies and governance.
Yeah, I agree. You know, and I loved how systematic Zali is and was in her Olympic days as well, about breaking down her goals into small chunks, assessing the risks as she went along, and as she says, having routines and also regularly getting out of her comfort zone.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible and a testimony to her approach that even given the extreme physical challenges she's put her body through, that she's never had a major injury.
Yeah, you know, as a former professional ballet dancer, that's incredible given 55 seconds of pure sheer speed on a,
I know.
On a steep ski
Can't
slope.
Imagine.
Yeah. I also loved how Zali has mentioned that the number of new female independent MPs in Parliament is such a positive, and how she's noticed now that more female staffers and even women MPs from the major parties are kind of feeling more visible and confident as a result.
Yeah, it's so good. And, you know, that really is the power of genuine representation.
Yeah.
Well, that's this episode done and dusted. Last episode, we promised you an episode on AI and is the hype justified? Never fear, it's in the oven and nearly ready for your listening pleasure. So look out for that one.
Indeed. In the meantime, have a great week. Take care and keep smiling. Ciao for now.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.